You know what that means? It's exempted from the ban on oil trains rolling through Vancouver. They literally time traveled back and wrote themselves a get out of jail free card that exempts them from rolling through a very populated area, right on a river, by the way. Any final thoughts from you from the Smog Blog on what the implications of Enbridge are, and what you and what other companies make out of this? We've just got 30 seconds left.
Sure. Well, you know, I've attended the last hearing at City Hall in Madison, where with Dane County Board of Supervisors, and just to give a quick depiction, Enbridge is bringing their big shots to Madison, Wisconsin for this, although it seems like a small place in the big scheme of things. They brought their head U.S. counsel, Ron Johnson's one of his top.
We have to go. I'd like to record some of this with you and put that on the website because it's terribly important. We here in the Pacific Northwest are facing very, very similar scenario that Dane County is facing, and we're not doing enough about it at this point. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, February 16th, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks. Kate Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOOAM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Got the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts. At least that's the way the story goes.
Tune in to KABU Monday, February 16th at 7 p.m. for another broadcast from the Steam Radio Syndicate, performing live from a tugboat in the Willamette River. Their focus this time is the Ballad of Frankie and Johnny.
He was her man, but he done her wrong.
Again, that's the Steam Radio Syndicate, Monday, February 16th at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This story has no morrow. This story has no end. This story just goes to show that there ain't no good in men. He was a man, and he done a wrong.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This morning we're departing a little from our usual focus on the environment to talk about Japanese culture and spirituality in the wake of the March 11th, 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster in Japan. My guest is Marie Mutsuki Mockett, whose family owns a Buddhist temple 25 miles from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. After the earthquake and tsunami destroyed the nuclear facility, radiation levels prohibited the burial of Marie's Japanese grandfather's bones. At the same time, she was grieving for her American father, who had died unexpectedly. As Japan mourned thousands of people lost in the disaster, she wondered, how does one cope with overwhelming grief? Marie is the author of Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye, which describes her experiences in Japan in the aftermath of events that shook the country to its core. Marie, welcome to Locus Focus.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much, Barbara. It's such a pleasure to be on your show.
It was a pleasure to read your book, actually. And it was really an introduction for me to things about Japanese culture I knew nothing about.
I'm so glad. That was part of my goal.
So I guess we should sort of lay out first that you, let's just talk a bit about your lineage and so people understand where you're coming from in relationship to your whole Japanese journey.
Sure. So my mother is from Japan, born and raised. My father was American. My parents were both music students. They met in Vienna, Austria, in the most romantic way possible. They were in standing room at the opera, and she's 5'2", and couldn't see because he was 6'2", and he was standing in front of her. And that's how they met, and they got married. And I was born in California, but I started going to Japan, I think my mother told me, my first trip I was 2.5. And when my parents married, my mother didn't speak any English, so she spoke Japanese to me. And then my parents spoke German to each other because that was the only language they had in common. So Japan really, and everything that Japan is, it really imprinted itself on my imagination from a really, really early age. And I found it strange and different, but I also really loved it early on and was always trying to understand why it struck me as such a different place and was always trying to figure out what were the elements of Japanese culture that also made it so special and beautiful.
Well, today, one of the things I'm really interested in is talking about the things about Japan that you and Westerners who are totally, 100% Western lineage, find strange and different about Japan in relationship to what happened, now it's 4 years ago, with the disaster, the nuclear and tsunami earthquake disaster. And so I'm really interested in looking at the cultural fabric of the country that caused the responses to that particular disaster and why you chose to kind of go right into the midst of it. So first, let's talk a little bit about the temple that your parents own or your family owns, because I think that's a concept that might be a little strange to a lot of our American listeners. What does it mean to own a Japanese temple?
I know it is kind of unusual. I mean, I think one of the things to keep in mind about Japan is that when we think of Japan today, most of us have this impression of it as an incredibly modern place, like, Tokyo, skyscrapers and robots, and all of that is part of Japan, but all of that is relatively recent. And older listeners will remember a more quote-unquote old-fashioned Japan that was almost pre-modern. And I saw the tail end of that as a child. For example, at the temple, and I'll explain about the temple in just a second, there was no flushable toilet until 1989. And indeed, a lot of the country didn't have modern sewage until the 80s. So if you only went into the cities on business, if you were a Westerner, you would have seen only, the bullet train in very modern Japan. But if you'd ventured out a little bit into the countryside, you would have found this very warm, sort of pre-modern Japan. And in other parts of Asia, there's still traces, right, of pre-modern cultures. And Japan was like that, too, before it tried so hard to modernize, particularly after World War II. In the case of the temple, in Japan, most temples are inherited. They're passed on from father to son, and this has been going on for generations. It's one of these old institutions that makes Japan unusual because it has this very old culture that it's preserved, and that's one of the ways that you can see very old Japanese culture even within a modern society. And I sometimes joke just to sort of get the point across to people, the temple system is almost like a monarchy where the king has to hand off the kingdom to the oldest son. And you can imagine all of the problems that this causes. What if there is no oldest son? What if there's something not quite right with the oldest son? What if the oldest son says, as my grandfather did, I don't want to be a priest, and rejects the keys to the temple? All of that has been, those sort of problems have been part of the drama of my own family's temple. But in general, it has been in the family for several generations, and it's located in Tohoku in Iwaki, as you mentioned. And I've been going there since I was a really little kid, before I even realized there was anything unusual about spending part of your summer vacation in a temple and among gravestones and among, statues of Buddha and incense and all of this. And it was only really when I probably became a teenager that I started to wonder, wait a minute, what is all this stuff and what does it mean?
Well, when you're talking about the temple system, are these temples all Buddhist or is there a range of religions that they represent?
The majority of temples in Japan are Buddhist. Most people in Japan Well, first, most people in Japan would tell you that they are not religious. But then if you were to talk to them, you would learn that they probably have some sort of temple affiliation, because Buddhism as a religion tends to take care of the ancestors and to guard ancestors in the afterlife. Most Japanese also, to some degree, are Shinto. Shinto is the indigenous religion of Japan. It's an animistic religion, so this means that in Shinto, gods appear in rocks and trees and flowers. And in very, very ancient Europe, in the Western countries, of course, there were also these sort of animistic religions, right, where the numinous, where the godlike power existed in nature and wasn't just in one Judeo-Christian form, but there was this magical power absolutely everywhere. And Japan has preserved its own version of that tradition, which makes it really kind of extraordinary to have a modern country that has preserved a polytheistic, animistic religion, plus this overlay of Buddhism, which a lot of Westerners argue is more a philosophy than a religion. And then there are some Christians, although most of the Japanese Christians I have met will also go to Shinto shrines. So I don't know how can I say this. I feel like a lot of in the West we have this idea that, you know, you either believe or you don't believe. There's one God. There isn't one God. I'm an atheist. I believe in God. God is the Father. No, I don't believe. You don't tend to run into that in Japan. I don't tend to see people on TV, for example, arguing for or against abortion, because it's almost like the religious mindset is inherently so flexible, inherently so able to see the power of what we would call God in so many places, that it's hard for Japanese people to just accept one God, which is funny because Westerners often say, you know, the Japanese are very vague. But then they would look at us and think, but you're so strict and rule-based. And I kind of think sometimes these cultural differences go right back to almost this religious background that we all inherit without even realizing that we're inheriting it.
Well, the diversity of the kind of religious viewpoints that seem to infuse Japanese culture seem an interesting contrast to a concept that Westerners have of Japan as being a very homogeneous society.
Yes.
Though I understand, I mean, I used to believe that it was like just all very homogeneous, and then learned about the indigenous people who are closely related to Native Americans and the Inuits.
Absolutely.
And so it's a little bit more complicated than that. But I wonder, with this overall, at least the veneer of having a very homogeneous society, how you have this overlay of really flexible and diverse religious beliefs and practices.
Yeah, it's one of the things that makes it really rich. And the other thing about Japan is that it's highly regional. So in the book, for example, I talk about some of the festivals that are celebrated in August where Japanese people welcome home the spirits of their ancestors. And depending on where you live in Japan, you would welcome home your ancestors differently. And after spending some time with them, you would send them back to the afterlife differently. And so, and then the different ways in which you might do this probably reflect where the people who settled in that part of Japan came from, which is very interesting as well. So for a small country, in terms of landmass, about the size of California, it does have a lot of diversity within its regions. And yet, when you talk to Japanese people, if especially when I meet Japanese people in the West, and I'll say, well, what is it that you miss about Japan? And it's always sort of the same things. They miss the food, they miss the festivals, the matsuri, in which gods are celebrated. They miss hot springs. They miss a sort of feeling and a sort of atmosphere that they get in Japan that they don't get here. So there is that sort of shared sensibility and that shared way of viewing the world. And I personally think, you know, one of the things that contributes to that shared way of viewing the world is just this very basic love and appreciation of nature. An example that is often used is for when Nissan first introduced the Infiniti car to the West, for example, they tried to use the Japanese ad. And in the Japanese ad, there were lots of pictures of nature and a car driving through the woods and very calming music. And they play this ad in the States. I remember when this ad debuted. And somehow this ad failed to capture the fantasies and the imagination of people undergoing middle-age crises in the West. And they had to jettison that ad and start completely over again with something that worked for the Western imagination. And yet all of this nature imagery really worked well in Japan. And I think it speaks to one of the big differences in the way that we look at the world, and probably also speaks to why so many of us in the Pacific Northwest are attracted to Asian culture, right? Because we do value nature so strongly.
Well, one of the things that was interesting to learn in your book was that a lot of the concepts of Shintoism actually infuse the Japanese connection to nature, and also the whole sense of cleanliness and purity and simplicity that we associate with Japanese design and aesthetics. So let's talk a little bit about how Shinto, what role it plays in forming that connection.
Well, I should stress here that these are my personal observations, and I'm not a university scholar, so there may be someone out there who disagrees with me. But, for example, one of the things I say is, if I were looking just at a magazine, like a women's magazine, it might be filled with ads that say things like, you know, this cake is sinfully delicious, or go on and have a piece of cake and repent tomorrow, or something. There's almost like a Judeo-Christian message in the way that a lot of our advertising is pitched. I would never see that in Japan. I would never see any sort of guilt associated with food. What I would see is the food would have a...
Are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, I think we lost you for a second.
So sorry.
Okay, we're back.
Okay, good.
Back to the food.
I would probably see that the food would have some sort of a face. It would be a character. Am I still there with you?
Yes, you are.
Okay, good. And that to me is a reflection of Shinto, where everything is alive. And because I feel like, you know, and in advertising in Japan, absolutely everything has an avatar. From if you look at an ad of a laxative that's showing a healthy digestive tract, there would be a digestive tract with a face looking happy, or a digestive tract looking unhappy. Even a bowel movement is going to have a face, you know, because everything is sort of animated within the landscape. And so I tend to think that when people sit down to design objects in Japan, they already have that in their minds, that they're trying to make a beautiful object that has a soul, almost. I've never written an article on this, and I really want to, but the difference between Japanese children's books and Western children's books is also fascinating, because when my son, I read Japanese children's books to him in addition to Western children's books, everything always has some sort of face or character to it. And it has the effect of making him feel like, oh, yes, the landscape is alive. So even if a Japanese person doesn't go to a Shinto shrine all the time, they're kind of getting that messaging just from the culture, which is derived from the religion.
Well, you also mention in the book that you'll like be walking through the woods and you'll see signs that gods inhabit this area.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And this is very old, where a tree will be marked off with a piece of rope, or a rock will be marked off with a piece of rope, or a piece of paper, or a whole mountain will have a gate, a torii gate, in front of it to make it clear that that mountain itself is sacred. And there are famous examples. I mean, Mount Fuji itself is sacred. But it could also be just randomly when you're walking through the woods and all of a sudden there's a waterfall and there's a rope across it to tell you that there's a god living inside. And it's a really beautiful idea, right, that nature is powerful and that there are gods living inside nature, and that we have to take care of them and that they will then take care of us. I find that reciprocal attitude really beautiful, and there's great wisdom in that.
Well, actually, I think I had an experience like that in southern Utah once, where I was hiking to a waterfall, Lower Calf Creek Falls, that's in the Escalante's Grand Staircase National Monument. It's an incredible place. I mean, here in Oregon, of course, waterfalls are a dime a dozen, but they're all magical. But there's something about being in the desert and coming across this amazing waterfall, and it was like this little oasis, and it's a good hefty hike up there, and you get there, and there were a few other parties that were scattered around the waterfall. I felt like I had just entered a chapel. It had this real sacred feeling, and there was this quiet that was just so powerful and maybe very loud. The quiet filled the air. And I've actually never had that experience going to waterfalls in the Northwest, and it may be because we have so many of them. So
I feel like it's a healthy attitude to feel that way when you're out in nature and you run across something that seems miraculous like that. I feel it's it's part of a healthy expression of just being a person.
Well, we're talking this morning with Marie Matsuki Mockett, who's the author of Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye. And we're going to start talking now about some of the greater challenges that are described in this book, which starts right after the 9.0 earthquake that shook Japan and was at the epicenter was in northern Japan near Marie's family's temple on March 11th, 2011. And as you probably recall, the earthquake generated a tsunami and then eventually generated a nuclear meltdown. So I want to start by asking you, how did you find out about the earthquake and what was your initial response when you heard about this earthquake?
Well, you know, there's a big time difference between New York, where I was living at the time, and Japan. And I think a text came through on my phone really, really early in the morning from someone in the UK who texted me and said, I just heard about this earthquake in Japan. You know, man, I'm really, really sorry. And I read this, and since I'm originally from California and we constantly have earthquakes, I sort of thought, whatever, Japan always has earthquakes. And I started to fall back asleep. And then I thought, well, but why am I getting a message, you know? And I went and I looked at the internet, and there were the initial photos of it, and I was just completely shocked. That this earthquake had happened. And I mean, Japan has had severe earthquakes in the past, and there have been earthquakes when I've been there. So I didn't really think about it as being so significant. And then I saw that the tsunami had happened, and then I saw how wide the area of impact was, and then I saw that it was going to affect my family. I was just stunned. You know, my mother had always warned me about the tsunami. She had always said, now if we're at the beach and the water starts to disappear, you don't get to go out and look in the sand. She said, the minute you see the water receding, you have to run away. And I would sort of roll my eyes and say, yeah, okay, whatever. And so I just was in complete disbelief that this thing my mother had always warned me about had come true. I couldn't believe it. And that was the reaction of a lot of Japanese when I went to talk to them. They said, we couldn't believe that this had happened. And one thing that I don't read a lot in Western reporting is that with the tsunami, there isn't necessarily one wave. There are successive waves. Some people told me about 7 waves. So sometimes a wave would come in and recede, and people would go down to inspect the damage. And then another wave would come in, and so there are people who died that way. But you know, people would just say it was just absolutely mesmerizing, horrifying, shocking, and the kind of event that just so completely rewrote that landscape so quickly. It's just so hard to believe. I mean, this is a place that I've loved since childhood, and I just couldn't believe that such a massive disaster had befallen it. And then with the nuclear disaster, and we're still not entirely sure what's going on with that nuclear power plant, the insidious thing about radiation, of course, is that you can't see it. And in the book I talk about a Buddhist priest taking me to see his temple, and his town is Tomioka, which is kind of within the exclusion zone. People are allowed in, I think, between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., and he took me to see his temple. And it just, you know, it looks like a town where time has stopped still. The weeds are overgrown, windows are broken, et cetera. But you can't see the radiation. So you have this weird, creepy feeling of something here is not quite right, but I can't see what it is. It's just chilling that this could happen to a place that you're familiar with and that you've loved for so many years.
Well, I was trying to draw from my own experience when I was reading your description of your response to seeing the devastation in Japan. And I remember going to Santa Cruz about 6 months after the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989.
Yes.
And it was just astounding to see downtown Santa Cruz. Again, you know, the buildings didn't look, they were still standing at that point. It's before they tore down the whole downtown. But what was really weird is they all had Halloween decorations up. And this was March when I was there. And it took me a moment to kind of like make the disconnect and go, oh, nobody's been inside these buildings since October 17th.
Yeah, I remember that. Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about that feeling of time standing still. I was really moved by your description of that temple. And the other part of it that's interesting to me is you dressed up in a hazmat suit, but the priest who took you just put on his mud shoes.
I know, wasn't that amazing? He had grown so accustomed to going in and out of this.
I think we're losing you. Are you there, Marie?
I am here. I don't know what's going on. going on.
Okay.
Let me try. He had grown so accustomed to going in and out of the nuclear zone. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Just keep talking.
Okay. Okay. He had grown so accustomed to going in and out of the nuclear zone that he just said, you know, the radiation is in the soil. It's not in the air. So he said, I don't care if I cover my body or not. And he just had a set of shoes that he wore that he kept in a bag, and he would put them on and walk on the ground. And then he would put them in the bag when we left, and he would put them away. But for me, he said, I want you to put on the full hazmat suit.
Now, I'm curious about that. I thought it was rather odd. Is he right that the radiation is just in the soil, or is that his form of denial?
I don't know. You know, he carried a Geiger counter with him, and he was absolutely delighted by the Geiger counter. I have to say that people in Japan love electronics and toys. It's a very playful culture, and, you know, early adopters of cell phones, early adopters of figuring out what technology can do and all of that. And so here he was with his Geiger counter, and as we would go up and down hills, he would say, hey, look, the numbers are going up, it's beeping. Hey, when I open the window, see, it beeps harder.
Oh, boy, we're getting dosed.
it was just this sort of subversive delay. And then he would say, but don't worry, you're not here for very long, and you got more radiation on that plane flight from New York than you will get today visiting my hometown. And yet when we went into his temple, which had been badly damaged, was a wooden temple, probably, I think I said it was 350 years old. I have to check my notes. And it was badly damaged. There was mold. You know, there were mushrooms coming up out of the ground. The ceiling was damaged, and so the dust kept falling. Then the Geiger counter really, really, really beeped. And I assume it was because there was still dust and particles and things falling out of the roof and the ceiling area to the floor. So the exposure was greater. And it must be like that as you're going through the radiation zone, that there are areas where the radiation is just in the soil, and then there are other areas where it's still falling. The other insidious thing is we don't really know how much is coming out of the nuclear plant itself. And then depending on which way the wind blows, you may or may not get radiation.
I want to back up a little bit, because I mean, people may not be quite familiar with exactly... probably most everybody knows about the meltdown of Fukushima, but as far as like the impact that it had in this region, first of all, how far away from the nuclear reactor is this temple that we're talking about?
So this temple's really close. I mean, I think this temple must be something like 5 miles, 5 to 10 miles. I don't have my notes in front of me. I would have to check. I think there were three zones around the nuclear power plant. There's the absolutely no one can access it at all zone. Then there's another zone where people are allowed in, I think, a couple times a year now. And then his is the third concentric circle where they're allowed in from 9 to 3 during the day, but they can't light a fire, and there's no running water. And there's a constant loudspeaker blaring, a woman's voice saying, you're only allowed here from 9 to 3. Do not light a match. You know, there's no running water. In the event of a fire, we cannot put the fire out. And there are police cars running around the whole time making sure that there's no looting.
Now, why are people, I don't understand, why are people being allowed in there from 9 to 3 every day?
I guess, because they think they're going to get to go home. And so they go in the case of this particular priest, they go in to empty the mouse traps because they say there's a significant mouse and rat problem, because I guess all of the cats... either cats were taken away, or a lot of the animals, I think, were killed and slaughtered. So there's a big rodent problem. And so people go in to change their mouse traps. They go in to get supplies out of their houses that they might need. Sometimes people go in and do a little weeding or pruning because the vines, it really reminds me of Sleeping Beauty. You know, the vines are growing over everything, and people go and they clip back these vines. Japan's very tropical, so... vegetation grows very quickly and very, very earnestly. So people go in to clip the vegetation. And in the case of the temple, people go because they want to remember their ancestors. In this traditional way of thinking, the grave of the ancestor is where the ancestor lives. And so during Obon or during Ohigan, these are times of the year when the curtain separating our world and their world is thin, the ancestors come home, and so then people want to be able to go and pay their respects to their ancestors, and they want to feel that their ancestors are protecting them. And a responsible priest's job is to care for all of these souls within the temple grounds. So switching over to my family, my mother's cousin, who's the head priest of our temple family, never evacuated Iwaki, which is further away from the nuclear reactor than the temple that I was just talking about. But my cousin said, people called him and said, we are leaving Iwaki. Will you take care of our ancestors? And Senpo, my mother's cousin, said, I will stay here and I will take care of all of the ancestors for you so that they can watch over you and so that you will be safe.
So that's a lot of responsibility for him.
Yes.
Now, so in Iwaki, people had sort of the option of leaving or staying because it was outside
Correct.
The exclusion zone.
Correct. Yes, that's right. And it was one of these towns where people might remember in the news, supply trucks didn't come in with food. And they kept skipping the town and not stopping in. And so there was a dearth of supplies, or the stores that did have supplies required people to line up in the hot sun for hours in order to get anything to eat.
Now, why?
And then people didn't want to line up because they didn't want to be exposed to radiation. So it was incredibly stressful.
Why did the supply trucks skip the town?
Well, it's never been made 100% clear whose decision it was not to deliver the supplies, but they were afraid of the radiation. So whether it was the truck driver who simply thought, I don't want to go in there, or the truck driver's boss who said, you don't have to go in there, we don't know. But essentially, the companies that were supplying food to the stores to then to distribute to the people in the towns were not distributing the food, or some did and many elected not to. And so that's why there was sort of a shortage of supplies in a number. And it wasn't just Iwaki, in a number of the towns kind of in the immediate circumference around the impacted area. And there was also, this is important, there was also no running water for a long time. No electricity. Of course, that's common with an earthquake. But the water was cut off. And I mentioned that in the case of my family's temple, there was no flushable toilet until 1989. Well, there's still people in Iwaki who have actual wells. And so my family was able to have water because they would simply go to the neighbor's house and use an old-fashioned well and dredge up water.
So did your cousin have concerns about needing to stay at his temple and take care of all his the community's ancestors? Was he torn between staying and leaving?
You know, he told me he wasn't. I called him hysterical. You know, I was the hysterical American envisioning all of these disaster movies. It's really embarrassing to think about it now. I would call. I couldn't get through a lot of the time, and then when I could, I would say, you need to leave. And this cousin is about 70. He has three sons. And I would say, could you just at least send your children away? And he would say, we all want to stick together. And then he would make excuses like, oh, well, we don't have enough gas in the car. We only have one car. The roads are clogged. Nobody can evacuate. And finally, he just said to me, Marie, I'm not afraid to die. And it's my job as a priest to be here in a time of need. This is exactly the kind of situation in which I have to make sure that I'm here. And he said, only if I'm the last person in this town will I leave. Later, when I went to see my family, they said, oh, yes, you know, people would just sort of wander by and see if we were here. And they would see us, know that we were here, feel comforted, and then they would leave. And so they said we couldn't leave. We couldn't evacuate if we wanted to.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking this morning with Marie Matsuki Mockett, who's the author of Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye. I'm wondering about the quality. I mean, you mentioned earlier that Japan has lots of earthquakes and it's had quite a few tsunamis, but the addition of a nuclear disaster seems like it really changed the Japanese people's ability to deal and cope with this disaster. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the difference between what happened in 4 years ago and what you might have learned about previous great earthquakes and tsunamis from your family, from your mother and your grandparents.
Well, I was asking my mother, I said, has anyone ever in our family ever seen a tsunami? And she said that my great-grandmother saw a tsunami in the south of Japan. And it was my great-grandmother who told my grandmother, and my grandmother who told my mother, and my mother who told me. And I apparently only met my great-grandmother when I was like 2 and a half, so I don't have a memory of her. But that's sort of how the lore of the tsunami gets passed down. And this is the insidious thing about tsunamis, is that they skip generations. So just as the generation that remembers or experienced the tsunami and thinks, oh, we must never go through that again, just as they're disappearing or have disappeared, that's when the next tsunami tends to strike. In the case of earthquakes, you know, Japan has, I mean, there's so much lore that goes along with earthquakes, but Japan, being a modern country, just like us in the West, has learned how to build its buildings to withstand those, to withstand the quakes. So once upon a time, if you look at woodblock prints from the 19th century, earthquakes were devastating. You know, wooden buildings fell, and people were stuck underneath the buildings, and then fires started and swept through cities, and people died in massive numbers. And we still, you know, you see that in the news. Like if there's an earthquake in Pakistan or in China or I think even parts of Turkey where there have been these really devastating earthquakes, a lot of that is because the construction was very rudimentary. And you know that if Western building methods have been applied, the buildings would have withstood the shaking, and then people, you know, more people would have survived. But you're right. The tsunami in this case was so large, so unprecedented, that there was really very little that people could do other than not to have been near the water in the first place. And then the nuclear disaster, which is ongoing, is just such a monster that's just so difficult to contain. I think it's created tremendous anxiety and soul searching. And on the other hand, you know, people who live on an island and want to have air conditioning and refrigerators, et cetera, need to have some source of power. So there's a great deal of dialogue that goes on about, you know, what are we supposed to do? How can we live powering all the things that we need? And it was so interesting in the first year, certainly after the disaster, I would listen to conversations. I would eavesdrop. I'm a writer. I eavesdrop. I would listen to people, and they would all talk about, even down in Tokyo where they didn't have any electrical shortage, I would hear people say, well, I'm keeping my temperature in the house, you know, like around 80 degrees so that people in other parts of the country can have enough electricity. And there seemed to be this great collective effort to work together to not need nuclear power. But, you know, people forget very quickly. And I think I was reading in the news that there is a plan to turn on a plant either this year or next year. People's memories are very short. And when you speak to experts, of course, they will tell you that nuclear power plants in general are safe, and that the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant was an aberration because it was so close to the water and it was built with, you know, old technology.
Of which there's many other. We have ones in the Northwest. There's one in Washington State that has the cooling pools for the spent fuel rods on the roof. I mean, that there's many, many reactors built like that in the United States. So, what I find really painfully ironic is that this is Japan's second or third major nuclear disaster, and it's a country that kind of came through this terrible firestorm. Well, it was, the conventional firestorm in Tokyo, but of course the bombs on over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the Nagasaki bomb affected your family.
Yes.
And now the country's going again through another nuclear disaster. And part of me wonders is like, why did the Japanese people think that nuclear power was something that was benign, while they understood the wrath of nuclear weapons and they didn't see the possible connections and the dangers of nuclear energy?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I know it is so weird. I mean, we, the Americans, did build that nuclear power plant, the Fukushima Daiichi plant. That was something that was designed, I think, by GE. I probably was constructed by Japanese workers, but it was designed by the West. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. You know, Japan was defeated in the war, and then there was a period of occupation. But it is extremely, I agree, it's very, very eerie and very, very upsetting. I mean, I think in the case of nuclear power, it's incredibly attractive to a country that's an island. And it's so embarrassing because I didn't really realize, I think until really recently, just how reliant on nuclear power Japan is. I, for the first time, rented a car and drove all over Japan a couple of years ago, and it suddenly dawned on me, oh, this oil, you know, this gas that I'm putting in this car, everything has been shipped here. All the gasoline has come on a boat to this little island so that I can drive my car. That's how reliant on, that's just how difficult the challenge of energy is in Japan, because it is a tiny island. So I mean, it's naturally going to have to face this question of trying to go green or trying to save energy earlier, I think, than other places are. You know, like we can sort of put blinders on in the United States. Well, some of us can, some of us don't. But they really don't have any choice but to ask themselves these really hard questions.
Well, one last thing I want to talk about is the healing process for the thousands of souls that were lost through this disaster. Yes. And one of the stories that really struck me was the story of Café de Monk. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this priest and his, what his charge was and what his challenge was.
Isn't he a wonderful character?
He's my favorite.
Yeah. December. Yeah. I just love him. His name is Kaneta. And I've said earlier that the Japanese are really playful, and they also really love puns. The language is full of onomatopoeia, and it's also full of puns. And so Kaneta calls himself Café de Monk, and he says, well, I'm a priest, so I'm like a monk, even though he's married and has two sons. He always he's a musician, too, and he loves to play Thelonious Monk when he holds his cafes, which I'll explain in a moment. And the word monk, pronounced with a Japanese accent, would be monku, which means to complain in Japanese. And so what he does is he heads out in his little pickup truck, which is filled with cake and coffee, and he sets up cafes in temporary housing shelters. He puts on Thelonious Monk. He serves coffee and cake to the people who are living in these temporary homes. We say temporary, although they've been there for 4 years. And the last time I went to visit some friends who live in one of these communities, they said to me, well, we're going to be here for another 5 years. But he lets them talk about what they're experiencing. He listens to their survival stories. And, you know, the post-traumatic stress from an event like this is pretty severe for some people, and it's ongoing because people don't know when they're going to go home or they haven't found the remains of their loved ones, etc. And he comes up with some therapeutic techniques to help people deal with their grief, and it can be as simple as asking them to make a clay figure of a Jizo, which is an enlightened Buddhist being who helps the dead souls of children or lost souls cross over so that they can be reincarnated. He might do that. There are some people who feel that they are possessed by the spirit of the dead, and for those people, he will do an exorcism. I mean, he just tirelessly goes out and listens to what other people have to say and then helps them. And he's just an extraordinarily powerful, wise, compassionate, but very sort of disciplined figure who has given a lot of hope to a great many people and has subsequently trained a lot of other priests to do the same kind of work. I think that Buddhism in Japan as an institution, because it's inherited from father to son, had just sort of been seen as, oh, well, it's a job, but do the priests really care? And one of the things that Kaneta has done is to really dig into the wisdom and the compassion of Buddhism and to show modern priests how to apply that to people who are having problems today. I think he's a remarkable person.
So I'm assuming you're going to be going back to Japan many more times and continuing this journey.
Absolutely. I'm planning to go in March. I was just there in December, and I took my son with me. And, of course, my son doesn't know exactly what happened, and he just sort of plays with some of the kids who live in the homes and the shelters and provides them with a distraction. And it's something to be able to go back and to see people and to see how they're doing over time. I think in the chapter that you're referring to, I was introduced to a woman, a grandmother who had saved her grandchild by carrying her over a mountain, only to lose the grandchild to an illness like a year later. And so I like to check in on that family and see how they're doing.
Well, I hope that all of your friends in Japan continue to heal from this great trauma, and be interesting to hear further stories from you in the future.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara. It was my great pleasure. Thank you for your interest in my book.
Sure, thank you. We've been talking with Marie Mutsuki Mockett, who's author of Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Julia DeGraw with Food and Water Watch about the campaign to stop Nestle from building a bottled water plant in the Columbia Gorge. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music for a Zen meditation. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon. Although the United Nations calls it torture, 80,000 prisoners across the United States are in solitary confinement. This includes pregnant women, youth, and people with mental illness locked in small windowless cells with no contact for up to 24 hours each day. Join us on Prison Pipeline as Disability Rights Oregon unveils proposed legislation to stop the use of solitary confinement in Oregon prisons for persons with serious mental illness. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on February 16th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a live performance by West African artist Alpha Yaya Diallo on February 28th at 9 p.m. at the historic Bob White Theater in Portland. Diallo is the three-time winner of the Canadian Juno Music Award, and his performance ends the celebrations of Black History Month. Again, that's West African artist Alpha Yaya Diallo, Saturday, February 28th at 9 p.m., at the historic Bob White Theater, 6423 Southeast Foster Road in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And yeah, you do have it tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up is Health Watch. Today, we will hear an archival interview with Gretchen Reynolds. She's the author of the New York Times column, Phys Ed. A host, David Naiman, talks with Reynolds about her book, The First 20 Minutes, new findings about physical exercise.